How to View the Existence of Evil was presented by Ron Julian on May 31, 1998 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1998. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
What I want to do today is talk about what I was planning to talk about last week. I had a request to do that and changed my mind and thought, well, what the heck, I'll do it. This is my thoughts that I put together here are in response to a question that someone asked me, not in this group, a while back. Let me read you the question that I was asked, and you'll see that my response only begins to touch on the question. It's a very big question. The other question I have is the problem of evil. This, I know, is a very old question and one you may be particularly weary of. It is, however, an important question to me. Accepting all things from God's hand, yet holding on to the fact that God is only and all good, yet clearly experiencing evil in my life, this leads me to confusion. I can accept that maybe my perception of what is truly good and truly evil may be wrong, but if I can't use my perceptions to evaluate things in life, then how can I know anything or know that I know anything? And how can God use evil and not be evil? I don't believe he is evil, but in trying to understand his providence, I always come to this question. If it is possible sometime, I would very much like to hear you discuss these things. Well, you can see what my reluctance to launch into this. It's a pretty ambitious topic, and I feel a little presumptuous in trying to answer it. And let me say right up front, there's one part of the topic that I'm not going to talk about today. It's one of the big parts, probably one of the biggest, but I'm not. And that's the issue that we talk around here a lot, about the sovereignty of God, the question of God determining ultimately all that happens in the world, or is the course of history solely determined by the free will actions of human beings apart from the determination of God? This is a very important question, and presumably most of you are aware of the kind of answer that we would give to that question around here. I believe in the sovereignty of God. I believe that ultimately history is a story that God is telling. And Jack has made what I think is a very helpful analogy to the picture of an author telling a story which has evil parts to it, but ultimately the story itself is a good story. I think that's a very helpful way of thinking about things. We talk about that around here a lot. In fact, that's the topic we're talking about on the radio show, the In Search of Truth radio show. If you were to listen tonight, you would hear us talking about that topic again. So there's plenty of opportunity to talk about that question around here. I want to look at a sort of a different part of the question. Essentially, the question I want to ask is, how does the Bible tell me to think about God in the light of all of the evil and suffering that is in the world? It seems to me that you don't have to believe in the sovereignty of God to have to face this question. Even someone who is an out-and-out, we'll use the word Arminian, someone who believes that the human will is totally autonomous from God and we are the ones who are calling the shots and the way things go here, even granting that premise, which I wouldn't grant, we are still left with a world where God clearly could do a lot more than he is doing to act against evil and suffering. I mean, even granted that we're the ones who are messing things up around here, the fact is God could be doing things differently, but he's not. Unless we believe in a God who is so weak and impotent that he's sort of sitting back and saying, gosh, I really wish I could help, but it's just beyond me. I can't figure out what to do, which I don't see how anybody could look at the Bible and conclude that that's the picture of God that we have there. Since that's not the picture, then we're sort of left with the question, this God who is good and all-powerful has us living in a world like this. And how does the Bible tell me to think about that? Now, part of my reluctance in approaching this question is I don't really think of myself as much of a philosopher. I mean, everyone is a philosopher in a sense. I mean, we all ask questions about life and try to make sense of it. But if I have any sort of gift involved with the stuff that I do, I don't think it's the gift of sitting in my study and meditating on the human condition and coming to brilliant answers. I don't look down on that. I know people, I think, who are very good at that. I'm not particularly good at it, I don't think. If anything, I'm an exegete. What I do, if I do it well at all, it's because I have this passion to understand what it is the biblical authors were saying. I think that God has revealed himself to the people who wrote the Bible. And because of that, I think we can come up with real, true answers to some important questions about life by figuring out what it was the biblical authors said. And part of my passion for that, and I don't know if you're like me in this or not, but I find it comforting to know what's the deal, if you know what I mean. I like to know what is actually going on. Even if the truth is a difficult truth to deal with, ultimately I think knowing what's going on is a comforting thing. It frees me from having to worry about all the possibilities of what might be going on, and I can focus on dealing with what I have come to understand really is going on. And that, so on this question, it seems to me that the Bible has told us some things that tell us what the deal is. What is God doing? How am I supposed to think about him in the light of the world that I live in? The Bible has told me some things about that. And I want to talk about two of those things. There are many things we could talk about. I just want to pick two. Let me take the more difficult of the two, difficult just emotionally to deal with. It seems to me that one of the very important pieces of information that the Bible gives me about the world that I live in is that I and you and we are all living under a curse. Now, that may not seem like good news to start right off, and I suppose it isn't in a way, but it is the picture that the Bible paints. You and I are children of Adam and Eve. They and we are rebels against God, and the world that we live in a sense, is kind of the down payment on the price that we owe for that rebellion. We see that in the story of the fall itself. And you can just take a really simple example of what does God say to Adam and Eve when he comes to them after they have rebelled against him and disobeyed and eaten the fruit. One of the curses is you will eat your bread by the sweat of your brow. Meaning, you're not living in the garden anymore. You're going to be out there in a world where food is going to be difficult to come by. You're going to have to work hard and sweat to make it happen. You're going to have to work to get it out of the ground. And as we see, as we look around in the world that we live in, it's not always so easy. When we think about things like poverty and drought and famine and all of that kind of stuff, that's not an accidental byproduct of living in an otherwise wonderful creation. The Bible presents that pretty squarely as the decree of God, that we live in a world where it is difficult to make ends meet because we are rebels against God. The most explicit statement of what God has done to us, I think, is found in the first chapter of Romans. Let me read starting from verse 18. One of the most sobering sections you will find in the Bible. Romans has some great and profoundly encouraging statements filled with grace and hope. But before Paul gets to those, he says this: "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who suppress the truth in unrighteousness because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. For even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools, and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man, and of birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures. Therefore, God gave them over in the lusts of their hearts to impurity, that their bodies might be dishonored among them. For they exchanged the truth of God for a lie, and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this reason, God gave them over to degrading passions, for their women exchanged the natural function for that which is unnatural. And in the same way also, the men abandoned the natural function of the woman and burned in their desire toward one another, men with men committing indecent acts and receiving in their own persons the due penalty of their error. And just as they did not see fit to acknowledge God anymore, God gave them over to a depraved mind, to do those things which are not proper, being filled with all unrighteousness, wickedness, greed, evil, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malice. They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, arrogant, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, without understanding, untrustworthy, unloving, unmerciful. And although they know the ordinance of God that those who practice such things are worthy of death, they not only do the same, but also give hearty approval to those who practice them. Now, in terms of the argument of Romans, this is just the beginning of an exposition of the human problem and the solution that God is providing in the gospel. But before we get to talking about the solution, you've got to be clear about the problem. And part of what Paul is saying here is a very clear exposition that God has given humanity over to its evil, that we're kind of stewing in our own juices, and that this is the decree of God. This is what he has decided to do. When we think about some of the things that have happened in the world around us, the events that have transfigured this community here recently, this is stuff that's described in this list that Paul gives of what God has given us over to. We don't tend to think about it that way. Our natural way of thinking about things is to put God on trial and evaluate his character in terms of what we expect life to be. We look around at the world and say, hey, this world could be a lot better. What's the deal? How could God be good? I mean, doesn't he know what a terrible place this is? As I understand it, the biblical answer is, not only does he know that it's a terrible place, but it was his decision that we would live in a terrible place because we are rebels against the truth. In this world, you and I do not merely experience the love and grace of God. We experience the justice of God. We have already experienced, to a certain extent, the price that his justice demands for our rebellion against the truth. I like John Gerstner's comment, where he said, if you really understand the holiness of God, we talk about the problem of pain, but he says the real problem seems to be the problem of pleasure. Why would God be as gracious as he has been to people who are rebels against him? Why is the world as good as it is, given the fact that we are running pell-mell in the opposite direction, away from the source of light and truth? That's the way Jesus pictures it. Remember when he encourages us to be like our Father in heaven? How does he describe our Father in heaven? Our Father in heaven is the one who sends the rain on the just and the unjust, on the good and the evil. That is, God, in dealing with the evil and rebellion in this world, is being more gracious to us than we deserve. But it's not totally grace, because we have already received something of what we deserve. The world that we live in as I said, the Bible is kind of picturing it in a sense as like the down payment. We're under a curse. We tend to take everything around us for granted. This world that I live in is mine. And then we complain about everything that ought to be better. And we charge God with being in the wrong somehow because things are not better than they are. But in fact, the opposite is true. To the extent that this world is evil and a place of suffering, it's no more than we deserve. And to the extent that this world is a place of good and beauty and satisfaction, it is more than we deserve. We don't look around at the world we live in and say, why would God be so generous to people like us? We look around at it and say, hey, this place sucks. This could be a lot better. What's the deal? God, I'm ticked off at you. Now, I want to clarify one thing. I am not saying that there's anything wrong with recognizing that things in this world are messed up and wanting them to be better. That's a healthy thing to do. That's a good and truthful thing to do, to see evil in the world and say it shouldn't be that way. What I'm talking about, though, is our coming to understand, first of all, that God has already been more gracious to us than we deserve, and that the world we live in, this is not the best of all possible worlds in the sense that this is the best that God can do. God didn't take a shot at perfection and miss. We're living in a world that has been, as Romans says, subjected to futility. And it was God's decision to do that. So in a sense, I have a picture in my mind now. It's like we tend to think that the world we're living in now is the main show. You know, this is it. And God sort of has to justify himself to us in terms of how well is it working out now. But in fact, I think it's more like we're in the lobby and the show really has yet to begin. We're in the lobby and there are two doors, and one of them is going to condemnation and one of them is going to the kingdom of God. And in a sense, we've already begun to experience both. There's a very real sense in which I understand something of what hell is all about by living in the world that I live in. I already have a taste of it. It's the absence of God. It's the corruption that eats away at the heart. It's the alienation that results from all of that. And at the same time, though, that's only the beginning of the story. The grace of God has reached in, even into the midst of a place where judgment has begun, to reach in, to redeem, to open the eyes, to call people out from this place. And so in that sense, we've already begun to taste what the kingdom of God is all about. We've come to taste what his grace is about. We've come to understand what his mercy is about. So it seems to me that if we're going to try to reconcile our picture of God, the good God, with the evil world that we live in, part of the answer that we have to come to terms with is what I've described here, this first part of the answer, that this is not the perfect world that God would say, This is what I want for you all. This is the best that it could be. This is a broken world that we live in. And it was God's decision that we would live in a broken world. So if we're going to understand him and charge him with having done wrong, at least we need to understand what we're charging him with. He's not ignorant. He's not sloppy. He knows what he's doing. We are living, as Paul said, under his wrath. We are already under his wrath. We have a foretaste of what it means to pay for turning away from God. The second part of the answer is a much more hopeful and optimistic one, although it is also difficult to deal with somewhat. If I'm talking about my perceptions of God in the world that I live in a world where I experience suffering and frustration and evil, another part of the picture, it seems to me, is that I need to learn to recognize that God is constantly pouring out his love, his grace, his mercy on his people. The problem is that he does it in a way that doesn't fit our intuitions. We have one picture of what it would look like for God to be loving and gracious to us in a world like this. His picture is different than ours. There are all kinds of things that we could point to. I always think of stories from the Old Testament that help us to get some sort of a picture of the way God does things. We could tell the story of Israel as God delivers the people, the children of Abraham, from a great famine, and then, having done that, takes them into a land of promise, which he has promised to Abraham, where they will dwell in safety and security, and milk and honey is flowing, you know, that picture. That's an accurate statement of the biblical story. God delivers Israel from famine, and he takes them to the promised land. But how did he do that? Well, how did he deliver them from famine? Joseph had 11 other brothers who decided they were jealous of him and essentially send him off into slavery in Egypt. While he's in Egypt, he stands firm in his integrity. He's seduced by the wife of an official, but he will not give in. And because of that, she falsely accuses him of rape, and he ends up in jail. That's Joseph's story. That is also, at the same time, the story of how God delivered Israel from famine. Because in the process of Joseph's being in jail, I mean, the story goes on, because of his ability to interpret a dream, he ends up having a position of influence and importance. And as you know, as the story goes on, we see how it culminates in that classic statement where Joseph tells his brothers, "You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good." God brings about this great thing, but he does it in a way that teaches everybody involved some very hard lessons, and they have to go through some really tough stuff to arrive at the great thing that God has done. And likewise, when you look at the story of the Exodus and going to the promised land, they have to go through slavery in Egypt. Moses comes and announces their deliverance. This is all stuff that David has taught us earlier from Exodus. Moses comes and announces their deliverance, and what's the result? Pharaoh makes things, you know, now they're twice as difficult as they were before on them. The story is told clearly from the perspective that this is God's doing. God has set out to deliver them, and he will. However you debate the question of the sovereignty of God when it talks about God hardening Pharaoh's heart and all of that, clearly the point of all of that is God hardens Pharaoh's heart so that they don't get out too early. We've got 10 plagues that we've got to go through here, and we're going to go through all 10 of them. Because there is something that everybody involved, the Egyptians, the Israelites, everybody's got some learning to do about who God is and what's going on in the world. And because of that, God is quite prepared to take them through a whole series of very difficult things to teach them those lessons. This is the God that we're dealing with. This is the model that we need to have. Sometimes, I mean, we rightly picture God as our Father and Deliverer, and those are good images, but if we're going to think about him as a Father, then we need to include the kind of picture that the author of Hebrews has, where he pictures God as a Father who disciplines us. And he says, discipline is not fun. I think many of us are in a place where we can understand something in this life of how I could love someone and inflict suffering on them. And I do it not because I want them to suffer, but because I know that where they're going to be if they don't go through that is much worse than where they're going to be if they do go through it. So that's the God that we're dealing with. when we try to sort out, when we're looking at the world around us and ask ourselves, how do I reconcile this picture of a good and all-powerful God with the kind of world that I live in, it seems to me that we have to at least take these two things into account. And I'm sure there's much more that we could say about the picture. But at least these two things have got to be a part of our picture, it seems to me, or we're not understanding the world we live in. And one of them is the evil that we find in the world around us is a judgment of God upon us. He has given us over to it. We live in a world of self-centered people who delude themselves, who hurt other people. As Paul said, he talks about murder and lust and all kinds of things going on. God has given us over to that. And even when I go to look at this world to look for the evidence that God's love and mercy is at work, I need to recast my thinking to ask myself, what does love and mercy look like when it's at work? It's more complicated than I would tend to think. Love and mercy looks like a father's discipline. Part of the question I was asked originally had to do with our perceptions of good and evil. The person was asking, do I somehow have to change my view of good and evil in order to see God as being, you know, how do I think of God being good and then look at the world of evil around me? Somehow am I looking at things that are really good and calling them evil, or what, you know, how do I put that together? And I guess my answer is basically no, I don't think that's right. We have been given a God-given understanding of right and wrong, good and evil, and we're not wrong to look around us and see that there is evil in the world. And we're not wrong to think that God is good and that that goodness is opposed to the evil that we see in the world. But what I think we do have to do, and probably if there's anything that I see as the thrust of my teaching and what I understand about the Christian life and what I would like to encourage you to consider as you're thinking about what it means to be a Christian, is this idea that we have to change the framework within which we consider these questions. Here's the kind of thing I mean. What if I went to Marine boot camp with the expectation that I was going to Club Med? You can see what would happen in that situation. Everything that happened to me, I would be griping and complaining and saying, this is the worst vacation I ever had. I want my money back. But the problem is that I'm not on vacation. And once I figure out that I'm not on vacation, but I'm at boot camp, it doesn't change the reality that I'm living in. But it changes my perception of it, because I understand that there is a purpose to the things I'm going through. Instead of being a terrible vacation, it's a really good training for the military. And that changes everything. What if I looked at a surgeon who was coming at me with a knife and thought that he was a mugger in an alley? I back up. I run. I said, get away from me with that knife. But if I realize that I'm sick and somebody had better cut me open or I'm going to die, now the person coming at me with a knife looks very different. These are things. It seems to me that's, in essence, what it means to have a biblical perspective on life, is to come to see the world that I'm living in within the right framework. The fact is that the world we're living in is more like boot camp than it is like Club Med. And the God I'm dealing with, who has decreed a life with suffering and evil, is not a mugger in an alley who has set out to do me harm. He is a surgeon who is doing what needs to be done to solve the problem that I have that is so deep that I don't even really yet understand how deep it is. Although if your life has been like mine, maybe you're starting to understand how deep the problem is. But I'm quite sure that I haven't yet got a hold of how deep the problem runs. If we see it in those terms, then the question about how to think about God, the God who put me in this difficult world that I live in, it becomes a different one. I look at him differently. I look at myself differently. And what's most encouraging to me, ultimately, is that I see the Bible saying that that change of perspective, which I would say is the essence of wisdom, what the Bible calls wisdom, I would say at the heart of biblical wisdom is that change of perspective that I have just described. That I see myself in relationship to the world I live in and the God that created me in a different way. That when I have come to see myself and the world I live in and my God in the way that is that fits reality, then I am a wise person. And the choices that I make are going to be wise because I'm operating from reality. What I see in the Bible is the promise that such wisdom is the work of God. One of the most encouraging things to me about my life in this world, apart from the question of the hope that so drives the Christian life, the most encouraging thing to me about life in this world is the promise from God that He knows how to make us wise, that He can teach us to understand what's true, that He can teach us to understand what His love is all about. I always think of the prayer that Paul prays in chapter 3 of Ephesians. For this reason I bow my knees before the Father, from whom every family in heaven on earth derives its name, that He would grant you, according to the riches of His glory, to be strengthened with power through His Spirit in the inner man, so that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith, and that you, being rooted and grounded in love, may be able to comprehend with all the saints what is the breadth and length and height and depth, and to know the love of Christ which surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled up to all the fullness of God. That prayer that Paul is praying for his readers there is the prayer that we ought to be praying for each other and ourselves today, I think. That God would show us the big picture, that we would see how big His love is, bigger than the evil world that we live in, which is pretty big. So, in the end, I think the message is an optimistic and a hopeful one. But it's only optimistic if we look the reality square in the face first and say, this is the way it is, and then understand what God has promised to do about the way it is. Okay, well, we have 10 minutes that we could take to talk a little bit about this stuff if you'd like. And again, I remind you, if you feel uncomfortable about the microphone is not for the tape. You can be rest assured that your comments are virtually inaudible on the tape. The microphone is for us here so that we can hear what it is you're saying because of the acoustics of the room.
What is the wrath of God?
What is the wrath of God? Well, could you... Right. Could you clarify me for a little bit? What sort of an answer are you looking for? I don't mean that the way it sounds. I mean, so I don't head off somewhere and answer a question that you're not asking. What do you mean?
The wrath, my picture of the wrath of a person is that it's evil, it's anger.
Okay.
And it's destructive. It's not a loving thing.
Right.
Which theoretically has to be impossible for God.
Right.
So what is it?
Okay. Well, it seems to me that in the context that I understand to talk about the wrath of God are always talking about it in conjunction with the concept of justice. The picture, as I understand it from the Bible, is that evil in us, rebellion against God, calls for a certain just response. That God is not only right to respond to our evil, but justice demands that He respond to our evil. In rejecting Him, the appropriate response would be to reject us. And that the wrath of God, then, that is described in those terms, is His appropriate and justified anger at the rejection of truth and the rejection of himself in human beings. Now, part of what helps me in thinking about that is anger in human beings, if I'm understanding the biblical teaching, is a mixed thing. Anger is not necessarily an evil thing. Here's what I mean. God has endowed us with a sense of justice, a sense of right and wrong that mirrors his own. And I think our response to evil and injustice in the world, you know, I tell you a story about a guy who makes his living calling up old, lonely, and gullible people and bilking them out of their life savings by schmoozing them on the phone until somebody comes finally to look at their financial affairs and they've lost everything. And the person says, but, well, he was so nice. And, you know, okay, that person knows exactly what he's doing. I mean, he is robbing someone who is not in a position to know what's going on. There is what I think is an appropriate rejection of that behavior, to look at that and say that is evil, that is bad, and a certain kind of anger that is appropriate. What is the problem with human anger as we deal with our interaction with evil in the world is that we have limits on us that God does not. First of all, I myself am a sinful human being. And so if I put myself in the position of condemning the person who has done that without recognizing the value of mercy, even for something disgusting like that, then I have not understood my own problem of evil. So part of my reaction to evil is supposed to be to recognize I'm a person like that. And if mercy is appropriate for me, then mercy would be appropriate for that person as well. And I'm also supposed to recognize that I'm not the judge. I'm not God. And that there is something presumptuous and evil about me putting myself in the place of God to presume to make that judgment. But to respond to evil, calling it evil and rejecting it because it is evil, where my own emotional involvement is involved in that, I'm looking at that and saying, I see that and that's ugly and it's bad and I reject it. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think that's a part of the way God has made us. Like I say, the problem with almost all human anger is that our own selfishness gets mixed up into the middle of it and so it's always tainted by our own impure motives. But anger in and of itself is not, I don't see that as being an evil thing. So to describe the wrath of God then is it is essentially God. I think to describe it as wrath in terms of God's emotional state is probably more an analogy. I'm not sure, but I don't think we're to picture God stomping around heaven somehow, you know, going, oh, boy, this really ticks me off. I don't think that's it. But just like his love, when the Bible describes his love for me, I think it's not so much describing, I'm not saying that God has no emotions, I don't mean that, but the focus of it is not so much on God sitting around feeling really good about me. His love is a way of describing his good intentions towards me that he acts upon. His love is something that he does. Well, likewise, I think his wrath is something that he does. It is his righteous response to evil. So the judgment that's described in Romans, God in his wrath giving us over to sin, that's just like love shows itself in an act of kindness, wrath shows itself in an act of judgment. And I don't know if that answers your question, but that's the best that I would be able to do at this point, I think.
One of the things you alluded to a lot when people talk about the problem of evil and folks respond that it's God's discipline is that we use the word discipline as synonymous with punishment, and it's a not uncommon idea in modern Christian circles, actually probably in Christian circles throughout since Christianity began, and even before that, that the happiness one experiences, the good fortune one experiences on earth is directly correlated with how much of a friend you are of God. I guess that's the whole theme of the book of Job.
Right.
And so I was wondering if you could clarify, when you say that we have things to learn and the reason the world is the way it is because God has to teach us those things, if you would clarify how specific, you know, if you think of the example of Joseph and his brothers, it seems like his brothers evidently had a lot more to learn about God than Joseph did, but Joseph got the lion's share of the pain in that deal. So Joseph's brothers definitely benefited by Joseph's pain, even though it was Joseph's pain and not their pain. So just to talk a little bit about that idea that if I'm suffering, it's my own darn fault, and if I'm not suffering, I can pat myself on the back because obviously I was a lot more teachable than you were, who were suffering a lot more.
Right, right. Well, your basic thesis there, I'm just with you, absolutely. For us to try to correlate, to make that sort of, oh, I'm suffering, the really naive version would be, I'm suffering because I've done something wrong and God is getting me for it. The less naive but still wrong version would be, I'm suffering so I must have some lesson that I need to learn, and this other person who's not going through the same thing, as you say, they must have gotten it already and so they don't need to go through it. Yeah, that's not the picture that I'm painting. With Joseph, it's true that Joseph was a person of faith, I think, in a way that his brothers were not in that situation. But it's not as if a person of faith going through that kind of thing isn't learning lessons of his own. I mean, to actually have the opportunity to have to exercise that faith, to make the choice, I'm not going to be seduced by this person's wife, even though it's going to make things difficult for me and all of that. I think those kinds of situations are beneficial to us in the long run. So we're not told a lot about that, but Joseph is a person to admire, partly because he learned wisdom in the midst of real decisions that he had to make. One thing, in what I'm saying today, I am saying that there is a mixture in what we see in the world, that it is right, in a certain extent, to look at the evil in the world and to see it as a punishment from God. I mean, in his wrath, giving us over to sin and that kind of stuff. That picture in Romans, I don't think is meant to be, this is not a redemptive picture of how people come to be believers. This is the judgment of God upon creation. In the midst of that, God is reaching in and redeeming people out of that. But there is a sense in which I can look at the suffering in the world as the beginnings of what we as a race have deserved by deserting God. But when we come to think about, now, I as a believer, I have come to God, I have confessed my sin, I have admitted that I deserve whatever I get from him, and he has responded graciously and said, that's why I sent Jesus to die on the cross. I am a person who is living in a world under the wrath of God where I myself am not under the wrath of God. I am his friend. I mean, in very real terms, I as a believer am a friend of God. And it's in that context then when I can start thinking about the question, the disciplines that God brings into my life. This is not punishment that he's inflicting upon me to pay what I owe for my sins. Jesus paid the penalty for my sins. But nonetheless, he has not freed me from this world of difficulty and evil because there is great value in the lessons that I still have to learn by living out my life in this world and having to choose to trust God and choose to follow what's good and all of that kind of stuff. So in that context, then, I think it's right for us to say, the difficulties I'm going through are not a punishment from God, but they are actually a manifestation of His grace. And then that brings us back to your point again, finally, that we're not to picture this as a kind of a, okay, you messed up here, so you have to learn this lesson, and here it is. Nowhere in the Bible are we told that that's the way things work. We don't see the biblical characters really operating that way, I don't think. And it's foolish for us to try to think about our lives that way, because we do get into that kind of mentality. Like, okay, well, I know, I learned my lesson now, God. You know, I got it. Boy, got it, nailed it. You know, give me a test and I'll pass on this one. So, can we move on? Can we? But it's not that simple. I mean, God's purposes for us, my life, the lessons I'm learning in the midst of my own life, the lessons that you're learning in the midst of my struggles, I mean, it's all a very complicated web that I can't say to God, I know how this works, so I know how you ought to be doing it. And we're not claiming to know how He's doing it.
What, if anything, should I conclude if you are suffering more than me, or I am suffering more than you? Is there anything I can conclude there?
No. I don't think so. How, as you say, that's the book of Job. I mean, that's exactly the issue that it's confronting. And both ways. I don't think I should conclude, you know, if we have the teaching, which we ought to have, the biblical teaching that God disciplines His children and that He tests our faith and all of that kind of stuff, we don't want to sort of get on a reverse sort of high horse and say, you know, I suffered more than you have. God must really like me. I mean, which seems strange, but you can sort of get in that spot too, and that's not it either. I mean, it's, you know, that, you know, the story about that Jesus tells, the parable where there's the guys working in the field and they contract in the morning for a certain wage, and then all through the day people keep coming in, and then everybody gets the same wage at the end of the day, and the guys who are hired in the morning are griping and say, hey, those guys hardly worked at all and they got the same wage. Well, there's an element of that in our dealings with God and each other. All God has promised to do for me is just the little thing of rescuing me from hell, delivering me from sin, and bringing me into an eternal life of righteousness and holiness with Him forever. But He didn't promise me how that journey was going to go. He didn't tell me that I'd have a short, quick, easy one. He didn't tell me I'd have a long, difficult, troubled one. He hasn't told me either way. What He's told me is, you follow me and I'll lead you where you need to go. And He's doing that. So we've got no call to gripe or compare each other's journeys, because nowhere did He say that we're all going to get the same deal there. We're getting the same deal on the important stuff, the absolutely most important stuff. But here, your story may be very different from mine, both ways. So what we need to do is have compassion on each other and remind each other what is true, so that we can get through this journey and make it to the destination. Okay, well, we should stop.